You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us. Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Thank you so much for joining us once more for another episode of Murder, Mystery, and the Macabre Throughout History.
Yeah, that's right. We are just a couple of sexy old ladies who met online playing a very non-murdery game, and we learned that we both have an interest in horrible historic events, weird unexplained stories, murder. So now we get together every week and we tell you about these things, most every week. Almost, you know, we try. Things happen. Yeah. I am looking forward to today's episode, though. We have so much to talk about, and we haven't talked about it at all, really, about the Dell since I got home. And I'm very happy to say that we have to go back, you and me. I didn't get to see and do everything that I wanted to do, and I can't wait to go back, and you're going to love it. So we have to go back.
So want to go to there. I think I mentioned that I'm a huge Marilyn Monroe fan, ever been since my, I don't know, since I was 10 years old. And yeah. I wanted to go to the Hotel Del Coronado ever since I realized that this is a real hotel and you can stay there. Also, this is one of possible 5 basic facts I know about the hotel. So I know almost nothing. Yeah, please, I want to go there and I want to hear everything about it. And I know how you ended up there last month, but you should tell our listeners, I think.
Because I drove you up a tree going back and forth about
No, it was fine.
Yeah, a little bit. It's fine. It's fine. You're going to love it, though. I got you souvenirs. They're going to be coming in your Christmas box. Your Halloween box should be arriving any day now. Any day, your Halloween box will hopefully arrive. So for our 10th wedding anniversary, Paul had apparently looked into surprising me with a stay at the Hotel Del Coronado. He's been trying to get me to San Diego forever. We have really good friends that live out there. Our friend Merrill actually married us. But for ages, he's thought, especially since the migraines, that it would be a good place for me to spend some time. So he goes onto the website, and there were actually a lot of options at the Hotel Del, and he wasn't sure which part of the resort I wanted to stay in. He was pretty sure that it was going to be the Victorian building because, I mean, that's me. That's kind of who I am. But because I have wanted to stay at this hotel for such a long time, and because it is such an expensive place to stay, and there are a lot of different buildings to choose from, rather than surprising me and risk maybe getting it wrong, he decided to just tell me that this is what he wanted to do and this is what we would do for our anniversary. And Paul never comes up with a, you know what I mean? Paul's a, whatever you want to do, I'm okay with, right? So I kind of decide what we want to do and that's it. But he actually had said out loud, like, this is what I want to do. So of course, that's what we're going to do. But the stay at the Hotel Del, it was like 2 months back and forth of, we're going, it's going to be amazing, to, nope, we're not going, it's too much. We're not going. And I'm sure I drove you and my sister and Misty, like half my friends, right up a tree because I was just trying to even reconcile taking this trip. It's just been such a hard year between my health problems and people we've lost. And I just felt like I was feeling very kind of in a dark place and feeling like we had just spent too much time and too much money on really hard things, but you know, we just shouldn't do it. We should just wait a little while, save up some more money. But Paul insisted that we needed a break from all of this. And it's so rare for him to insist on anything that I agreed. And then I saw the prices at the Dell and they were shocking, shocking. So initially when I was looking, it was like, it was over $700 a night for the most basic room in the Victorian with a king size bed. And I think I actually cried. I was so just crushingly disappointed. There's just no way I could spend $700 a night on a hotel. There was no way. So I started looking into other hotels because the Dell was out of our reach. And I just thought at that point, I thought it would be a disappointment. Like, I don't know what I would expect from a hotel room that costs more than $700 a night, but like a view and massages and maybe meals are included. And there's like a resident dog also who will come and sleep with you if you want. Like, at least those things, right?
At least. It's
at least. And this was for a room with no view. No view. I'm sure there was a window in the room, probably, but it's an enormous old wonky wooden hotel, and the interior floor plan has changed so many times over the years, so who can say? So I was like, all right, it's fine. We're not going. It is what it is. So I looked into where we could stay using just our reward points, and then one day I looked, and the prices had dropped significantly. And so instead of $700 a night, the prices were in the high fours or low fives, and I realized that if we stayed at the Hotel Del for two nights, we could do it for about $1,100, and I had enough points to stay with points at other places for the rest of the trip. So $1,100 for two nights in a hotel is, I feel, too much money, but $1,100 as your entire hotel budget for six nights in San Diego is fantastic. That's less than $200 a night. So once I rationalized it like that, I felt a lot better about it. And we booked the basic king room. And when we arrived, we got upgraded. So our room was one of the ground floor rooms that opened right up into the hotel's main courtyard. It was nice.
How was it? Was it disappointing? Did you hate it? Did you love it? Tell us everything.
I loved it. I loved it. I know, I kept saying to you, I was like, I'm probably going to hate this place. And
I fear the same if you build something up over the years.
Right?
And then you're like, well, if I go there, then maybe it really sucks and I'm going to hate it. And
And there's all these extra things that you can do, but then when you look, they actually cost a lot of extra money, you know? So it's that's always the way it is. You know, the more expensive a place is, the less that's sort of included with your stay. But it was worth it. It was worth it. It's amazing. It's amazing. It was the first commercial structure to have been wired with electricity. And in 1904, it had the world's first Christmas tree lit by electricity, which is cool. Christmas season, I've seen photos, it looks amazing, and I was not disappointed. I really thought I would be, and I was almost like bracing myself to be disappointed. Do you know what I mean? And it's okay if you can't see the ocean from your room. Even our room that was in the inside courtyard, it's 2 minutes walk to the beach. You're right there. Also, the beach today is so much wider, so much wider. The hotel used to sit literally steps from the ocean. It was like hotel, small breaker with a few steps down, very small beach, ocean. There was really no beach. And the military has dredged for the naval base at North Island, which is also right there. So it created more land for the naval base at North Island, which is where the original Top Gun was. And it also created a larger lawn and much, much, much wider sand beach. It's a really good beach today. Just the fact that the beach used to be a lot closer to the hotel is something to keep in mind for later. So I should probably get into this story. I was just telling the folks in Patreon at game night the other night that I've been worried about covering this episode because there's so much to tell and I love it so much and I can't tell you everything. And it's, you know what? It's going to be fine. I'm just going to try to really stick as best I can as what's related to our story and not go too far off on like how they used to mill redwoods because you know I read about it. All right. So this is going to be a two-part episode. Today I'm going to be discussing the history of Coronado, the history of the Hotel Del, how it was built, how it came to be this amazing, amazing wooden Victorian seaside hotel that it remains today. And we're going to be discussing the arrival and the tragic death of the beautiful stranger at the Hotel Del. And then next week, we're going to be discussing how we figured out, probably, who the identity of this beautiful stranger at the hotel was, all the various theories surrounding her, and the haunting of the Del.
I can't wait.
It's going to be... I'm so excited. And just a warning, we are going to be discussing a suicide. All right, so I'm going to be very brief about history here. Of course, we had the Native American period, then Spanish colonization, then after Mexico won its independence from Spain in 1821, California was part of Mexico, which makes sense on a map. And then the territory became part of the U.S. after the Mexican-American War. and California gained statehood in 1850 as a free state. So legally, slaves were not allowed, but that doesn't mean that there weren't a lot of problems with the way minority groups were treated. The gold rush had started, and slaves were, in fact, mining gold for landowners. Both black slaves and Native Americans were enslaved in California after it was already illegal. There just weren't enough people around to enforce the law. And of course, very often when the law was enacted, there were enough higher-ups who also kept slaves and had no problem to sort of just make these problems go away, disappear. In addition to continued enslavement, immigrants, especially Chinese immigrants, began to arrive, and in 1854, the state Supreme Court ruled that if you were black, Native American, or Chinese, you could not give evidence in court. So, what does that mean? You can't give evidence in court. Well, that means if you are attacked or enslaved or robbed by a white person, you are out of luck, because any crime committed against someone who wasn't white, you could get away with it. If you can't testify in court as to what happened, then nothing happens. There were all kinds of just incredibly hypocritically xenophobic and racist laws enacted. We'll talk more about that later. It's just that this is often something you see, this era, you know, the gold rush, the American dream, and land, and slavery is abolished, no more slavery, yay! And I just want to be clear that, hang on, actually, because there were still a lot of issues, and they for sure included murder. California has, like everywhere, a long and interesting history with things to be proud of and ashamed of. Every other place on the planet is the same. I just feel like that has to be mentioned. All right, so now it's the 1880s. There's a railroad that runs from the East Coast to the West Coast, and people start arriving in huge numbers. In 1888, the population of San Diego surged from around 2,500 people to more than 10,000. Two of those people are Hampton Lovegood Story and Elijah Babcock Jr.
That's good names. I just think they're really good names.
I do too. And Everywhere I saw his name, I just saw Hampton L. Story. He never used, but I think that's such a great name.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So Story was born in Vermont. He fought for the Union in the Civil War. And then he was always a music lover, so he worked as a teacher and worked in a music shop until he could eventually afford to buy that shop. And then he expanded. Selling pianos wasn't enough. He wanted to make them. He started a piano company, Story and Clark, that would take him to Chicago, which is where he earned his money. And in the 1880s, he was sort of semi-retired, but still on the board of Story and Clark. Elijah Babcock Jr., he was born in Chicago, and he was a civil engineer who had worked his way up the ranks in a railroad, like from a very low position right up to like running the railroad, I think. Once he'd done that, he moved on and then was instrumental in the creation of Bell Telephone Company. He had an ice company. With the profits that he made, he invested into real estate, which was very lucrative. He was pretty much retired when he moved to California for health reasons. But he seems just like a very, he was the wealthier, I think, by far, of the two, and had been just a very, very savvy businessman. In 1885, Hampton and Story get together with Jacob Grundyke. He's a San Diego banker, and they purchase the island of Coronado for $110,000.
For back then, $110,000?
Yes.
Or that's not that that's a lot of money.
It's not nothing.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. And is it an island? We were just talking about this with one of our patrons, Brendan, at game night.
Yeah, he had spent time in that area because of his military service, I think. Do I remember correctly?
Yeah, exactly. My husband's family tried to get stationed there, too. One complaint you'll see when you read reviews of the hotel, sometimes people complain because there's too much military aircraft, but my husband really loves military aircraft the way I love wonky old Queen Anne architecture by the sea. So this place is, this is the dream.
It's a perfect spot.
It's perfect. It really, we just sat there on our anniversary, like drinking champagne and watching them do like practice maneuvers with like helicopter. Like there were men jumping out of helicopters into the bay. It was great. It's great. All right. So they buy the island, which I thought was a peninsula, but I was wrong. So let me throw a little Wikipedia your way about Coronado, quote, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the city has a total area of 32.7 square miles, which is 85 square kilometers. Geographically, Coronado is a tied island connected to the mainland by a tombolo known as the Silver Strand. The Silver Strand, Coronado, and North Island form San Diego Bay. Since recorded history, Coronado was mostly separated from North Island by a shallow inlet of water called the Spanish Bight. The development of North Island by the United States Navy prior to and during World War II led to the filling of the Bight by July 1944, combining the land areas into a single body. The Navy still operates Naval Air Station North Island on Coronado. On the southern side of town is the Naval Amphibious Base Coronado, a training center for Navy SEALs. Both facilities are part of the larger Naval Base Coronado complex. Coronado has increased in size due to dredge material being dumped on its shoreline and through the natural accumulation of sand, end quote. Okay, so it's a decent amount of land, and they buy it. And Babcock's work in railroads and other civil engineering helped him be really smart about it. So before work on the hotel begins, they build a power plant. They built 12-inch pipes under the bay that carried water from the wells in Old Town San Diego to Coronado. They built an ironworks. They built a brick kiln. They built, I can't remember what it's called, but it like a planing shop. It was like a wood shop because the wood that would be floated down on barges from San Francisco would arrive not cut. So it was like a shop to turn wood into boards. So they created basically just a small town that they'd need in order to actually build this enormous hotel. But their hotel was not the first. Another hotel, the Oxford, had its grand opening on July 27, 1887. This hotel is now on the grounds of the Dell and is reportedly very haunted. More on that later. It was originally located near the ferry terminal, and it was a three-story building made of redwood with 90 guest rooms. But also on the ground floor, it was more than a hotel in this brand new town, right? So there was a huge and excellent restaurant, a post office, a barber shop, and a drugstore. And this is where the architects and others stayed while they were building the Hotel Dell. We'll talk more about its haunting later. I have some interesting stories. Speaking of architects, the Dell's architects were James Reed and his brother Merritt Reed, and together they brainstormed what the most magnificent hotel that would be, to quote Reed, quote, the talk of the Western world. At the same time, they start dividing up parcels of land, and people are ready to buy it. There's an auction on November 13, 1886, and 6,000 people attended. Some of them row themselves over from the city, and some took the ferry. Bidding on lots started at $500, and the highest sale price of the day was $1,600. They sold 350 lots that day and made around $100,000, which helped them fund the hotel. So they also started the construction of a streetcar. They were naming streets. Babcock and Story each named a street after their wives. They planted orange trees. Like, they're ready. The progress is constant. They are creating Coronado. In March 1887, Mrs. Babcock broke ground with the first shovel of dirt. But there was still an enormous problem. The housing and development boom meant that carpenters were in very high demand and pretty much impossible to find. It was sort of like trying to find somebody to do work in your house during the pandemic. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
But they were rich, so they could solve problems. And 3 weeks after groundbreaking, a barge arrives, and it's carrying the first 40 of what would eventually be hundreds of Chinese-American laborers. I think it's important to mention the hell that many immigrants, but particularly the Chinese Americans, went through during this time in American history. I actually want to read you an article that I found on the Coronado Historical Association and Museum's blog. You can find it on coronadohistory.org, and we'll post a link to it in our sources, of course. And so they write the following, quote, the use of immigrant Chinese laborers in the West in the late 19th century produced massive infrastructure efforts like the Transcontinental Railway and the California Southern Railroad. This railroad's construction ran from 1880 to 1885, bringing Chinese laborers from Northern California as a non-union workforce. The laborers were vilified, but hired when it seemed that white laborers would not work for the payment of $2 a day, an exploitive approach with a long history. The Chinese were described as, quote, unskilled, which may have been the justification for their low pay and some way of assuaging the pride of the unemployed white workers. Either way, these Chinese men experienced a large part of anti-immigrant bigotry in the West well into the 20th century. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 outlawed any future entry by Chinese people into the United States. In 1880, the Chinese population in the U.S., mostly on the West Coast, was 105,465, possibly an imprecise figure given the difficulty of counting people who may not have wanted to be counted. The 1880 census shows the population of the entire country was 50 million, and that of California, 864,000. Thus, the Chinese percentage of the population in 1880 was 0.021 and 12.14, respectively. So, basically, they're saying, you know, they outlawed Chinese immigration, but when you look at as a whole, there weren't really that many Chinese people here. It continues. The act was both protectionist and racist in intent. The foreigner was blamed for low wages and economic uncertainty. It was a helpful way of deflecting the vagaries of an unregulated economy onto forces with little to no power of their own. Another significant building project in Southern California in the late 1880s was the elegant Grand Dam of Coronado, the Hotel del Coronado. Here, too, Chinese workers were brought in from the north to help build the eminent hotel in just 1 year. There was much talk in the press discouraging the hiring of Chinese labor, but to no avail, as they were certainly cheap and expedient labor as provided by their work on railroads. In a Coronado Evening Mercury memorandum, Elijah Babcock Jr. laid out his company's policy on their construction employees. Quote, "We never use Chinese labor when we can get white labor to do the work, and all the talk on this subject has been for political effect." End quote. 12th of November, 1887. Despite this, the accepted history is that there were several hundred Chinese workers who contributed to the Dell's creation. Indeed, barracks were built to house them close to the building site. An article in the same newspaper on the 28th of June, 1887, laid bare the issue of Chinese labor thus. One of the largest corporations in California, the Coronado Beach Company, has always had to employ numbers of Chinamen from the fact that the amount of work to be performed could not be done any other way. The fault is attributed to scores of white men who prefer to tramp, beg, and steal rather than earn $2 per day at some honest work. $4 a day would be no more inducement to them than half that amount. The author also cites smaller-scale businesses, laundry and vegetable sellers, that were run by Chinese immigrants and patronized by white customers because of the cheaper prices, who also found time to denigrate those services and products as, quote, filthy. The effects of such articles is ultimately one of a sad jockeying for position among the varied inhabitants of the young town of Coronado Beach, a reflection of the larger state and national picture of the growth and development of a new country. There was much opportunity to prosper and little real reason to cast aspersions on those who were helping build that prosperity. We may therefore celebrate yet another aspect of the Hotel del Coronado, the unnamed Chinese laborers whose own fortitude contributed to her beauty and fortitude. End quote. Yeah, you don't really find that too much in the history books, and I just felt like it was important to mention who was building this incredibly beautiful structure that I love so much. So the workers arrive, and they're hard workers, but they're not carpenters, right? But Reed has a plan for this. His plan is to start building on the simpler side of the hotel first, which, really smart, right? So that by the time they reach the front and the more complicated aspects like turrets, they'd have a lot more building experience. Another interesting thing to note is that the investors and the Reed brothers, the architects, they made a sketch of what they wanted to build, and then they just used that as a plan. They were like, build this. So I thought that was interesting. So there's an article called The Lady Who Lives by the Sea. It was written by Burke Ormsby for the Journal of San Diego History in the San Diego Historical Society Quarterly, January 1966. And I liked this passage from it because it's in Reed's own words. And I think you'll find this interesting. I did. Okay. This is just a few passages from it. Quote, in 1938, to help celebrate the 50th anniversary of the hotel, Reed wrote a monograph recounting the start of the building. He wrote, quote, at the time our story begins, the enterprise, Coronado Land Sales, was sufficiently developed to take part in full swing with the boom that was surging through the whole of Southern California. Mr. Babcock, who had kept in contact with the writer, was urging a visit to Coronado, and in December telegraphed most earnestly to come on no matter how brief the stay. Right here, Mr. Babcock said, we must build a house that people will like to come to long after we are gone. I have no time. It's all up to you. Reed added that a stenographer was called and given this rough description. Quote, it would be built around a court, a garden of tropical trees, shrubs, and flowers, with pleasant paths. Balconies should look down on this court from every story. From the south end, the foyer should open to Glorieta Bay, with verandas for rest and promenade. On the ocean corner, there should be a pavilion tower, and northward along the ocean, a colonnade, terraced in grass to the beach. The dining wing should project at an angle from the southeast corner of the court and be almost detached to give full value to the view of the ocean, bay, and city. End quote. Despite the problems, there is no doubt that Reed built a masterpiece. The crown room was his special pride. The ceiling is of sugar pine fitted together with pegs and glue without a nail in it. The shape was intended to be that of a king's crown, except that, due to the length of the room, any king who wore it would have to have a very narrow head. It's more of an oval than a circle. When the crown room opened, February 19, 1888, a reporter for the San Diego Union wrote, quote, this vast and elegant room with its wealth of appointment is a rare sight, especially under the brilliant incandescent lights that illuminate it. The polished floors over which an army of trained servants noiselessly glide, the high inlaid ceilings, the snowy linen and the flitter of the silverware and glassware combine to make it a most charming picture. The room may have its equal, but it is certainly not surpassed anywhere. End quote. During the construction, Reed was also much concerned with water and with fire hazards. Babcock had formed the Coronado Beach Water Company, bringing water from Old Town wells by ways of pipelines under San Diego Bay. Reed, though, was a cautious man. He installed two giant cisterns in the hotel basement, with concrete walls more than a foot thick. They were to store rainwater, a plan that never came off. There are rumors that they were used to store a variety of alcoholic beverages during Prohibition. And there are further rumors that in the dead of night, a truck pulled up to the hotel and a crew loaded such beverages aboard with instructions to proceed to the Spreckles mansion. But then, Hotel Del Coronado has been the subject of quite a few rumors over the years. Reed also installed gravity flow sprinklers with tanks on the upper story. There were two-wheel fire carts, many now still in usable condition. Still in usable condition, I have pictures of them to share. Continuing. In 1916, the first gravity flow sprinklers were replaced by 12,000 Grinnell pressure sprinklers, giving the hotel, even today, one of the lowest fire insurance rates in the country. Del Coronado was the first hotel in the world to have electric lighting throughout, but Reed, the Midwesterner, was a man to copper his bets. The electric wiring ran inside gas lines, so if the newfangled electricity didn't work, they could always pipe gas to the rooms. It did work. So well that some of the original cables were only pulled out in the spring of 1965. The steam electric plant supplied the entire city of Coronado with power until the mid-1920s. Thomas Edison inspected the final installation as a guest of the new hotel. In February of 1888, the hotel opened for business and 1,440 persons traveled from San Diego just to see the great hotel, even though it would be 2 years before the entire structure would be finished. End quote. I just thought all of that was interesting.
I love that description. So interesting. Yeah. Thank you.
And I've got photographs of, they have a great museum on site in the building. So when the Coronado Beach Company, that's the group that Story and Hampton formed, when they built that, they also built an ice house. And the old ice house is now a museum of the hotel. And I went there more than once, and I still want to go back. You're going to love it. I can't wait until we can go. All right. And those fire precautions that I just told you all about, they were pretty ahead of his time because there's a reason that most of these Grand Victorian wooden seaside resorts are gone today. And for a lot of them, it's fire. Also, I think the climate in San Diego, it's so dry and temperate that I feel like wood would do better there than it would, say, in San Francisco, mm-hmm. right? So the first guests arrive in late January of 1888, but the hotel considers February 19th the official opening day because that was the day that the first meal was served in the dining room. Initially, you could stay there. Initially, you could stay there for $2.50 a night. Sorry, I was born at the wrong time. Although then that was a lot of money too, wasn't it?
Yeah, so. But did you use the inflation calculator to see how much it would be today?
No, I'm sure it's horse money. They did have, well, I'll get into more of that later. Later on in their history, they did make accommodations in a wide variety of prices. And when Spreckles owned the mansion, owned the hotel, he actually created a huge, like, they called it a tent city, but it was... We're going to talk about it more next week, but it was like just tents that were wired with electricity mm-hmm. where people could like kind of camp out and still do everything.
I think that's super smart if you can take money from a lot of people.
Cater to everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly right. Why are you going to? Yeah, exactly. All right. So yeah, $2.50 a night. And there were about 400 rooms when it first opened. There were some entertainment that has since been replaced, including a nearby ostrich farm, which is where they also got feathers, a Japanese tea garden, and bowling alleys. Ads mention, there's a lot of ads. There's so many ads in the newspapers when you're doing lots of old newspaper searches, and it'll just be, it's like an article will end, and there's one sentence that'll say, like, the Hotel Del Coronado is fabulous this time of year. And you're like, wait, what? It's the strangest. I took a couple pictures of them. And, you know, the one I loved was, like, the sleeping porches. You know, to mm-hmm. take in the healing ocean air. It's just amazing. But yeah, I found quite a few of those, of course, because if you search the name of the hotel, it... Anyway, so it cost $600,000 to build and $400,000 to furnish. This is from their website. The Hotel Del has a great website. So much information, so many photographs. It's wonderful. And so this comes from them. Quote, an 1888 brochure for the new Southern California destination spoke of the comfort of the lobby, which was called the Rotunda. This is a handsome apartment, large and lofty, raised high over it, and running all around it is a wide gallery, which commands a view of the floor of the Rotunda, where the main office is. This gallery is much frequented by the ladies. Thither they resort for friendly social converse and to see newcomers entering below and registering their names. Although the hotel's historic lobby has changed over the years, its main configuration has remained the same, including its second-floor balcony. The lobby's elevator was also an original amenity. It's gorgeous. During a trial run, a reported £2,500 were easily conveyed. End quote. That lobby is... Wow. That I think it's the most beautiful hotel lobby I've ever seen in my life.
Really?
Yeah. Just everything I wanted it to be and more. I think I got kind of emotional when I first walked in. You know, it was like, oh, and the wood ceilings. And we got there just when they finished a huge hundreds of millions of dollars renovation. So they took all the ceiling pieces down and labeled them piece by piece. And then they like sanded them and refinished them. And then everything went back up. It was just gleaming. And all of the keys where they would have been back in the day are, they have these like grass green tassels hanging on a wall. And then this grass green, I know you don't like it, but velvet, like circular.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Mm-hmm.
Good vibes too. Good vibes. It was just, I can't wait to go back. All right. But what about the rooms, you said? I know, everyone wants to know. All right, so this also comes from their website. Quote, the Hotel Del Coronado featured more than 400 guest rooms that, according to an early brochure for the San Diego destination resort, said, quote, are large, well-ventilated and lighted, the sun reaching every room in the house at some hour of the day, with rug carpets, the handsomest wood furniture, and windows shaded with Venetian blinds. The suites of rooms are grouped around sitting rooms, giving every suite of four or five rooms a special reception sitting room, all with fireplaces and richly carved mantels with large French bevel plate mirrors. The bridal chamber was considered the handsomest guest room in the house, furnished in solid natural mahogany with upholstery and tapestry of pale blue and cream. In 1888, private bathrooms were a luxury, and the Dell was proud of its approximately 71 bathrooms containing bathtubs and 71 water closets, toilets. End quote. So, does 71 bathrooms for 400 rooms seem like enough to you?
I mean, back then.
I guess. It must have been good for the time if they were proud of it, but...
My concern is more about the toilets, but yeah, it is what it is. It was what it was.
It was what it was.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because when you went into where our room was, if you kept walking, if you walked around the inside corridors on the ground floor around the courtyard, you would see, and now when I started researching this, I was like, oh, that makes sense. You would find these really large, sort of octagonal shaped rooms. And then off the room, there'd be like three doors or five different suite doors. Do you know what I mean? Or it was just like a space before and after you turned a hallway, but they had some stunning, huge pieces of old Victorian furniture, like the sort of thing you'd see in an entryway or a mantelpiece. And I'm guessing these rooms would have been the original sitting rooms.
Yeah.
So that I was like, ah, makes sense. Mm-hmm. I love it. I've got a black and white photo of the bridal chamber to share with you. There's lots of arches everywhere. Today, you'll be glad to know that every room has its own bathroom. Like I said, when we were there, they had just finished this huge renovation that cost hundreds of millions, and it's amazing and worth every penny. There's a master plan video on YouTube you can watch, and if you're interested in old hotels like this, just look up Hotel Del Coronado Master Plan on YouTube, because I've actually saved it to make everyone watch it over Thanksgiving. They're never going to come back. My plan is working. No. Next up, what they're doing at the Dell is they're renovating the interior rooms, which is awesome because they're beautiful. They're really nice. The room is beautiful. I was thrilled with our room. They're just not that Victorian. You know, they're fine. Oh, another thing that was interesting is the hotel had its own little train, and the island, you know, the train went around the island until like not that long ago, I think. But in any case, for our story, wealthy people back in the day, when they didn't have private jets, you had your private rail car, right? And so wealthy families from Chicago, from New York, from Boston, they would take their fancy schmancy personal car across to the Dell. And then I think there was just somewhere to store it. And they'd like spend the summer there or the winter there. Or it didn't matter when they stayed there because the weather in Coronado was just perfect all the time. All the time. Paul has been telling me this forever, but I think I just didn't believe him. I don't know why I didn't believe him, but anyway, he was right. So the temperature typically varies from 50 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 10 to 25 degrees centigrade. And it is rarely below 44 Fahrenheit or above 83, which would be, in Celsius, it's rarely below 6 or above 28. So that is my dream climate. All right, time to get into the spooky, spooky happenings that happened 130 years ago tomorrow on Thanksgiving Day, which was November 24th, 1892. And this year, Thanksgiving is November 24th, 2022. It took me so much longer. I thought I was confusing something because I was like, no, what day was it back then? And I'm looking and I'm like, oh no, they're just the same. It's actually the same. Because Thanksgiving is a movable feast. It's just the third Thursday. It's not like it's every year on the 24th.
Yeah.
You understood this premise much faster than I did.
It's fine. It's fine. I'm fine.
So 130 years ago tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day, November 24th, 1892, a beautiful, elegantly dressed, dark-haired young woman arrives at the Hotel Dell. And because she is unaccompanied, she doesn't go in the front door and into that gorgeous lobby I just mentioned. She goes to this door just to the left. There's another set of stairs, and that is the unaccompanied lady's entrance. Because God forbid a woman on her own should walk into a hotel lobby anywhere. So she goes in the special entrance for ladies, and when she checks in for a rate of $3.80 a day, which also included three meals, and may I say, considering the brunch buffet was more than $100 a person, so $3.80 a day, which included three meals, that's a bargain. And at that time, you also had a bellboy assigned to you to help with anything you might need, like a butler. He did everything. These are the things I expected that would be included in a hotel room that costs
for $700
a night. Do you know what I mean? This is...
I was looking lately at luxury trains like the Royal Scotsman or the Orient Express, because that's something I really want to do, but then I always stop looking.
Me too. It's on my bucket list.
Yeah, but it's like the Royal Scotsman is like 9,000 euros per person for 6 days or something like that.
Yeah,
and there you have like a butler service, but I mean,
I briefly looked up the Orient Express once, and then I just noped right back out of there. That is like next level.
Yeah, same. I was like, oh, maybe we could do that for our 10th anniversary. No, we can't.
No, you can't. You could go to the Hotel Del, though. You could.
See, that's true.
It's true. So, yeah, so she has a bellboy, and he's assigned to help her with whatever. And her bellboy's name was Harry West. So she arrives, she checks in, and she asks the hotel clerk to please sign her name for her. She doesn't actually even sign the register. The clerk signs the register. And the name that is signed is Miss Lottie A. Bernard of Detroit. She was given room 302, which today is room 3327. So from the beginning, when she first arrived, there were concerns and problems with her appearance, really. Not with her obvious beauty, but more that she looked sad. She walked very slowly. She looked like she was in pain. She was noticeably pale. She was withdrawn. She was suffering from neuralgia, she had told them. That was just a catch-all for mystery pain. I think neuralgia back then might have been like fibromyalgia today, just like, everything hurts, why? And everyone, they're like, it's just neuralgia, that's your life now. I think it was the same back then. She also arrived with only a small handbag, no luggage, and when she arrived, she told the staff that she would be meeting her brother, Dr. Anderson, there, and that they were traveling together, and he had all of the tickets to claim their luggage. And they had parted ways briefly in Orange while taking the train down from Los Angeles, but she was sure that he'd be arriving any moment because the plan was to meet up here. So she spent a lot of time in her room, resting. Staff then learned that she was 24 years old, and she was suffering from neuralgia, but then as days passed, she did say that she was suffering from stomach cancer. And that made sense to the staff after looking at her. She seemed obviously in a lot of pain in her abdomen. She seemed incredibly depressed. Papers called her melancholy. But this was understandable because she explained that in addition to the stomach cancer, which was incurable, she also had a bad heart and she knew that she would die soon. And so, you know, Harry and the maid, the matron on duty, everyone's like, oh gosh, you know, and they're worried about this poor young woman. And every day she goes to reception, and every day she says, is there any news from my brother, Dr. Anderson? He might be with his wife. Have they sent a telegram? Have they checked in? And every day she's told, no, there's no sign of him. So she leaves the Del. She went to a couple of other hotels, but there was just no sign of her brother. So because she had none of her belongings and she wasn't feeling well, I think her bellboy actually suggested she should wire somebody in order to make sure she had enough funds if she had to replace things, right? So she sends a telegram to a Mr. Allen in Hamburg, Iowa, asking for money. She doesn't hear back immediately, which seemed to kind of depress her a little bit more. On the 26th, her third day, she was in such obvious pain that the staff asked if they could send for the hotel doctor to come and examine her and see if he could just help her, get her some relief, but she said no. She did, however, ask that the pharmacy, which was, so when the hotel was originally built, there were shops in the basement, and there are shops in the basement today, and one of those shops was a pharmacy. So she asks the pharmacist if he would please give her bellman a glass bottle, a sponge, and some camphor to bring up to her room. And the pharmacist sent those on up with Harry, as well as a bottle of medicine. On Monday, she spoke with the bellboy in the morning, asking again, have anybody had seen her brother? Had there been any sign of him? And he said there had been no word, and she was remembered to have said, quote, oh, no one comes for me anymore, end quote. So that day, she took the ferry into the city, and in San Diego, she visited Chick's Gun Shop, where she bought a .44 American Bulldog revolver and some cartridges. and she told the shop clerk that she was purchasing this as a gift for someone. And she said, you know, oh, how do these work? And, you know, would it be hard to pull the trigger? And how does this all work? And so the shop clerk, you know, he assures her that it wouldn't be hard to fire the gun. He shows her how it works. He showed her how to pull the trigger. He said that she moved very slowly, as if she was in a lot of pain, and that she spoke so quietly it was really difficult to hear her. I looked it up, and the Bulldog was a pocket revolver, so on the small side. One of the sources I saw said that it would be considered like a snub nose today. I also looked up the difference between an American version of the gun, because it's specifically mentioned to be an American Bulldog, and I was like, well, does that matter? And it was originally made in Britain, but I think it does matter, because I think, if what I've read is correct, it was a less powerful gun, and that I read it would only have been suitable for defense in very close range. So we'll probably talk more about that next week, but just something to sort of keep in mind. She also visited a couple of other hotels in Old Town San Diego, the Gas Lamp area, and she, again, was just trying to find her brother, any sign of him, and she did not find the man that she was looking for. So when she returns to the Dell, she's noticeably fatigued. I think at one point, somebody had to help her to get off the train. Like, she had to sort of be lifted off the train because she was so weak. And she asked for a really hot bath. She wanted to take a long, like a 1 to 2 hour bath to help relieve her pain. And the matron on duty was worried that taking such a long bath would be bad for her health. But Lottie insisted that this is what she wanted to do. So they prepared the bath. But only an hour later, Lottie, who now seemed to be somewhat upset, she rang for the bellboy to come up and help dry her hair. So what the accounts say is to rub her head, and sometimes you'll read things where it's like, it's really weird. Why would she have him come rub her head? Like, what the heck? And really what happened is her hair is wet to the roots, which all the sources say was odd at the time. Like, I think at that time, it's not that you wouldn't wash your hair, it's that you wouldn't wash your hair while you were taking a bath. Like, it was a separate thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. And she told Harry that what had happened was she was so weak that she was standing near the tub and she sort of collapsed and fell and her hair got wet. And then she didn't have the strength to dry it herself. She then asked for a whiskey. That's plausible. I have had that level of fatigue. I don't know if you did when you were going through your cancer treatments, but like, you can definitely.
Yeah. I can understand. Yeah.
Right? Like, I have days where it's like, I need Paul to help me with that kind of stuff or all.
Yeah.
Takes too much out of you, right? She asked for a whiskey. I think one other occasion she had asked for a glass of wine, but I just wanted to mention that there's no indication that she was drinking heavily at any point, you know. She was last seen around 9 or 10 p.m. on Monday night on the second floor veranda, dressed in black with a black lace shawl over her head. Her big black hat had been left behind in her room, and she was seen standing watching the storm whip up the sea, which was just steps away from her. The next morning, the assistant electrician discovered her body. She was on the steps that led down to the beach. The revolver was no more than 2 inches from her right hand, and there was an entrance wound on her right temple. There was blood on the step on the right side of her head, and she was pale, cold, stiff, and soaking wet. The electrician saw the gardener, so he ran over and talked to him, and the gardener was able to grab a tarp, and they were able to cover her. And then they contacted the coroner. And the coroner had the body taken away to Johnson & Company undertakers before anyone saw the body. So the police arrived, and the police went to her room in order to search for information, hoping to find out how to notify her next of kin. And that's when things started to get really confusing. In the fireplace, they could see she had burned all of the correspondence that she had had with her when she arrived. Now there was only a single envelope with some cryptic notes scribbled on it. We'll get into that next week. They also found some quinine pills in her purse. They found about $16.50. At the same time, while opening the office that morning, they found the telegram response from Mr. Allen in Iowa, and he had responded that yes, it was no problem. She could draw $25. And so they immediately wrote back to Mr. Allen saying, the person that sent you this telegram has died by suicide. And could you please pass this information on to her family? We're assuming you know her since you've vouched for her with monetary credit, and we don't know how to get in touch with anyone. And so it didn't take too long for them to realize that the name Lottie A. Bernard was an alias, and they had no idea who the dead woman was. A sketch artist went to the undertakers and made a sketch of her face, which we do have. This was published around the country with the following description. So this was in like newspapers all over the place. Quote, height 5.5 feet, complexion fair but sallow, medium length of black hair, two small moles on the left cheek, broad features, high cheekbones, brown eyes, weight 150 pounds, age about 26, good teeth, plain gold ring on third finger of left hand, ring of pure gold with four pearls and a blue stone in center, black corsets, large black hat. End quote. So what do you do in the Victorian era when you're not sure who the unidentified body in your mortuary is? Well, you embalm her and you go ahead and put her in the window of the undertakers. Why not? And that's what they did. And can I just say to people that I really feel like you will understand this and our listeners will understand when I say that we've covered postmortem photography. How on earth are there no photos? How did no one take a photo? I saw in one article mention that a photo was taken, but I'm honestly not sure if they actually meant a photo or if that was the sketch artist that they dispatched, because there's just nothing. And I'm guessing it's because it was felt like it was a suicide. So there wasn't any need to have evidence, maybe?
Evidence, yeah.
I just don't know how there are no photos. It's just, who is she? All we have is the guest book, and she didn't even sign that.
Yeah.
So who was the beautiful stranger? And it's really complicated, so we're going to talk about that next week. And today, I'm just going to leave you with the image of this beautiful young woman in her casket in the window of Johnson & Company Undertakers. So I did a search for Johnson & Company Undertakers, and I found an advertisement from 1905, I think, or 1906, which I think is close enough to be probably the same Johnson & Brothers & Company. You know, I think it's probably the same company. There wouldn't be two in that time period. And I found their address, and it's on a corner in the Gas Lamp District of San Diego. So it's got two big windows facing each of the two streets, and I'll share that in our Facebook album. So yeah, next week we're going to talk a lot more about what was found in her room, what it maybe means, and just the brain-aching series of twists and turns that led to her probably true identity. Yeah.
That's so interesting because I never heard about this. And right now I'm thinking, well, how difficult can it be? You have a telegram, you have a person who obviously knows her, but apparently there's more to it, and I really can't wait to hear everything. I'm very intrigued.
There's a lot more. Yeah, it's really interesting. And we're going to talk about the haunting of the hotel because I got special access to the most haunted room at the Hotel Del. And I'm sure a lot of you are thinking that it's this woman's room, but it's not. It's not. I also found a few stories in the newspapers over the years that could explain all the paranormal activity. I don't know. I can't wait. It's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. The whole thing was just, I want to go back. I just want to go back. I'm in a post-Hotel Del depression. Like the whole time we then moved on to San Diego and I was just like, I just want to go back to the Del.
It's calling for you. It's calling out for you.
I know. San Diego is just such a city. And obviously, that's such a foolish thing to say, isn't it? San Diego is just, it's a city. Well, obviously, it's a city. But Coronado, when you're on Coronado, you feel like you're in a small town that's just, but it's part of San Diego. It's part of the city. I also want to go back next time and in Old Town. I didn't find out about this hotel. When we go back, Johanna, the Cosmopolitan, I think is what it's called. It'll be in my video that I'm doing for Patreon. But there's this really cool old Victorian hotel in Old Town, and it's still got all the wonky old furniture. It's cool. It reminds me of like a tombstone-y kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, also, did I tell you that the store where she bought her gun, Wyatt Earp also shopped there?
Really? That's yeah. So cool.
I know. I had to remember.
It's peak interest for me now. Wow.
I know. That's all. There's no story. It's just he also shopped there, apparently. So, yeah. Something good. What, can you tell me about your week for a minute?
My something good. Well, it's absolutely not Victorian and not very interesting, but I'm very excited. I just ordered a treadmill. I wanted to have one for years now. I used to run on the treadmill at the gym I went to. And I prefer running indoors so much to outdoor running, especially now in winter. And I figured, first I thought I'm gonna go and sign up at a gym that would take me like 15 minutes driving there by car. But I just wanna use the treadmill. Everything else we have at home, like all the weights and all the
stuff.
That's
how I am with an exercise bike, yeah.
Yeah. And so I went there today and asked, well, do you offer like memberships for 1 to 3 months just during the winter? And they're like, no, you have to sign up for 1 or 2 years. And it's €50 per month. And I'm like, that's too expensive. I used to pay 15 euros in Vienna for the gym.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm like, that's crazy. Just want to use the treadmill. And then I, you know, did some calculations and I figured if I buy a treadmill in 1 year and 9 months, it will pay for itself because I don't have to go to the gym for that. Plus, I didn't even calculate the driving, the gas, and, you know, the usage of the car.
Of course.
So it's going to be sooner anyway. Definitely. So yeah, I'm very excited.
Yay. I am excited for you. And that really does remind me that I need to get an exercise bike. Big time. Big time.
Yeah.
I just need my stamina. I'm sure COVID, like having had COVID, I don't know if that's actually part of it, just getting tired easy, but it was so frustrating when we were traveling because I couldn't do everything I wanted to do. Like my body is just not cooperating. So it's going to be good to sort of build up some stamina.
1000%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff I want to do.
Yeah.
But the Dell was my something good this week. We spent our actual anniversary there. And instead of doing fancy dinner, we did the fancy brunch that they offer. It's the most expensive breakfast that we'll ever have at the most expensive hotel that we've ever stayed in. But it was a really good brunch. And also, we sat outside and we had like the green, and their green is actually really high quality fake grass, which we were happy to see the fake grass because, Sandy, do you know what they had everywhere were jade plants in window boxes? It's that kind of climate. It's an arid climate. And so it would be tremendously wasteful to have a real grass like that. So they have like a beautiful fake lawn that looks great. And then out to the beach and the ocean. And then on the lawn, so many dogs. So many dogs. The Dell is dog friendly.
I loved it.
Paul's like, next time we're driving so we can take Opus. And I'm like, and the other end of the beach is the dog friendly beach. And that's where the volleyball scene in Top Gun was filmed, I think. We're going to talk about some like it hot next week, I think, because we'll get into like some of the later history. But yeah, I want to live there. Coronado is the reason I'm now buying Powerball tickets. I didn't get my beach day, and we only did a little wandering, so we have to go back. Next time, when you and I go, more exploring. Paul and I had planned to do a lot of exploring, but we were only able to do a little bit, and they welcome you to do it. So you can just wander around. The staircases are next level dangerous. Like, the staircases are all really wonky, like, kind of wonky, and like, I kept thinking about the Rebecca Zahout case because the railings were so low. The railings were so low. And I'm sure they're going to be fixing that up at some point in the near future. But yeah, I just loved it. I was, you know, I think I said earlier, I was just telling the people in Patreon how hard this episode is because I loved this hotel so much and I want to do it justice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do a whole thing on Patreon for, you know, so I don't bore everybody with everything. But I wanted to send a shout out to Josh at the concierge desk at the Dell for helping arrange the ghost tours. And we did more than just one and the brunch. And it's funny, when I was talking to him, trying to book some of this stuff, he was like, did you know about the Spreckles Beach House? And I was like, I do. We covered it on my, so I think he might be listening now. I'm not sure. But also on that topic, the real quick, when I mention in the episodes about Max Shacknai and Rebecca Zahow, when Max fell, had his terrible accident, and Jonah ran from the fitness center back to the mm-hmm. mansion where he lived, literally, I could walk it in less than 10. It's so close. I could run it. It's that close. It's so close. And interestingly, the fitness center today is essentially where the beautiful stranger died, where the body was found, is where there used to be steps to the beach. So mm-hmm. it's just all kind of came full circle. But yeah, that mansion in Coronado, man, they're doing it up now, like working on it. It's, I love it. I love it. I can't wait to tell you more about it next week.
So excited. I'm so looking forward to it.
Yeah. What else?
If you enjoyed this episode, if you enjoy any of our other episodes, if you're looking forward to next week's part 2 episode, please do us a huge favor, go to your podcast app and see if you can leave us a rating and or review. They not only make our day, we love to read them, but they also help us with the algorithm. Visit our webpage, freshhellpodcast.com. There you find links to our merch store, to our Patreon, to our Instagram, our Facebook group, our PO box, our email address, which is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. Send us a message, send us case suggestions, whatever. We really love to hear from you. Please tell your pets we said hi. Take them to the Dell. Take them to the dog-friendly beach if you can.
Yeah, they'd love it. They really would love it so much.
And be kind to your pets, be kind to strangers or other people, and also be kind to yourself. And that's the hardest part of it all.
It really is. And remember, as you're trying to baste that Thanksgiving turkey this week, you know, just remember, if you're going through hell,
just keep basting.
Just keep basting.
Happy Thanksgiving.
My turkey impression. The dog loves it.
Bye. Every year, Annie. Every year.